You're listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live Podcast. The Fountainhead, Part 1, Chapters 9 through 15.
Well, good afternoon and welcome to the third session of the Fountainhead Discussion Group coming to you live from the Ayn Rand Institute. My name is Ben Baer. I'm a fellow and instructor here at ARI in partially sunny California. I'm going to be joined by my colleague Keith Lockage in a moment, but before that happens, I'll just make a few quick announcements. If you are watching us on one of our social media channels on either YouTube or Facebook, that's fine, but just know that if you want to participate in the discussion today, if you want to be able to make comments that we look at or ask questions that we answer, it'll be best to do that through our Zoom channel. And the way to do that is to go to the page that I have displayed on the screen right now, courses.ayn rand.org/webinars/fountainhead. Sorry, it's a bit of a mouthful, but if you go there, you'll be able to sign up for Zoom. You'll be able to register and you'll get reminders from us for future episodes. And you'll also then be able to participate in the conversation. This is a session that we're doing because we know many of you are at home right now. We know you are looking for things to do and to think about and to learn. And so if you know friends, if you know students, if you know teachers who are also interested in this subject matter, please feel free to share this link to let them know more about what we're doing. And another one of the reasons that we're doing this is because the Ayn Rand Institute sponsors one of the world's biggest essay contests. I think it's the world's biggest in terms of number of people who submit. And there's a $10,000 prize for the Fountainhead Essay Contest. Our deadline is on May 28th. We've pushed that back this year to give people more time to work on it. We're going to be finishing this discussion group just in time for you to have about a week to work on your essays in time to submit. So we're hoping that we give you food for thought in writing essays on this great American novel, The Fountainhead by Ayn Rand. So if you aren't previously familiar with our essay contest, there's again a link on the screen that you can go to find out more about what the essay topics are, the questions you're asked to write on, and what the rules are for entering. Last thing I'll make an announcement about is if you followed us this far and you're interested in learning more about Ayn Rand, and you're looking for more of the material that the Institute has to offer, best single way to do that is to go to your app store on either Apple or Android, download the Ayn Rand University app. Just search for Ayn Rand University. It's a free app, and there's hours and hours and hours of multimedia content from Institute speakers, thinkers, and from Ayn Rand herself. And there's so much that you can learn by taking a look at this and consuming some of the material there. So last thing I'll say is just some logistics for today. Keith's gonna join me in a minute, but we're gonna be trying to be interactive with the audience in a lot of different ways today. So we'll be asking you questions to see what you think about certain aspects of the reading for today from part one, chapters 9 through 15. If you wanna contribute your thoughts, the best way to do that is to put thoughts in the chat room. Now, we'll see the chat that you're writing. You won't be able to see the chat other people are participating in, but we want to be able to see what you're thinking. So please feel free to chat so we can see what you're thinking about some of these questions. If you have questions that you want to ask us, there's a separate module in Zoom. If you hover over your screen, you'll see a button at the bottom for Q&A. That is the best place to submit questions that we'll try to answer. If they're relevant to what we're talking about at the moment, we'll try to answer them in real time. Otherwise, we'll try to save them to the end of the discussion today. So I think that's everything I had logistically. Keith, are you out there?
I am here.
Great.
Hi. Should we stop the screen share?
Yes, thank you for reminding me of that critical point. There we go.
Okay. All right, so I'll jump in here. So we've finished part one of the book. That's where we are in the readings. And just as a reminder of some of the context setting that we did in the previous session. So part of what Ayn Rand is doing in The Fountainhead is she's showing us what what it looks like when different characters live different lives according to different philosophical premises. So that's, you know, there's a certain focus on that throughout the novel, on the characters and the arc of the arcs of the characters. And the four parts of the book, if you'll notice, are named after, and what we're seeing here is the character of Howard Roark, who's the hero of the novel, and how what his life looks like and the premises that he lives by in contrast to other characters. Now, if you look at the parts of the novel, the four parts of the novel are kind of named after the four principal male characters in the novel. And there's a way in which each part of the book, there's a certain focus on that character in relation to Howard Roark. We get that person's story sort of and backstory and information about them. So part one of the book is the title of part one is Peter Keating. And what we're getting in part, what we've seen across, you know, now that we've completed part one, we're seeing the story of Peter Keating kind of told in parallel, the early careers of Roark and Keating told in parallel. They both start out at the Stanton Institute of Technology. Roark gets expelled. Keating graduates as the top student with honors and triumphs and a job at Franken and Higher. They both go off to New York. You know, Keating starts to climb up the corporate ladder at his firm. Roark goes to work for Henry Cameron, who eventually has to retire and shut his office down. You know, so we see their stories being told in parallel. And it's interesting to look at the arc of their characters just over the course of part one. So what happens to Roark? He gets expelled. He goes to work for an architect that people consider, you know, sort of a has-been. Cameron has to close his firm. Roark gets a job with Peter Keating, gives him a job with Guy Franken's firm. Guy Franken fires him. You know, he goes to work for another architect and, you know, ends up getting a first client by sort of taking it from that architect. And he starts to have some success. He gets some clients. He makes a start in his career, but it's not enough to make a sustainable business. And he sort of ends part one in a kind of defeat. He's run out of money, he's run out of funds, he has to close his office, and he takes a laborer's job in a granite quarry, right? What happens with Keating? He works his way up the firm, you know, and the chapter sort of ends. He applies for this competition. He wants to become a partner in the firm. He has all these goals and ambitions. And the end of the part one, he gets everything he's been looking for. He becomes a partner in the firm. He wins the Cosmo Slotnick architecture competition. He even inherits Lucius Heyer's fortune, you know, and it seems like it ends in a sort of triumphant success. So if this were the end of the novel, if all there was in the novel was part one, and we were looking at the parallel careers of Roark and Keating, you know, we were to ask ourselves, who seems to be the success here? Who seems to be the one who's winning at life? You know, I think the answer is fairly clear. That it seems like what we're seeing is Keating's path and Keating's premises and Keating's choices and actions are the ones that lead to a triumphant success, and Roark leads to failure and misery. So.
Yeah, it's interesting. You mentioned each of the four parts of the book is named after one of the principal male characters. There isn't one named after Dominique, though she's certainly a principal character. Though there's an interesting question as to why that might be. I suspect it has something to do with the fact, well, she's a focus throughout. She's a focus throughout the book, and there's development that we'll see throughout. We'll maybe talk a little bit more about her later. So yeah, I think you're right, Keith, that at the end of part one, it looks like Keating is really on top of the world. If you go by the way things look on the outside. But one of the things that we get, especially in the second half of part two, is even more insight into what's happening to him on the inside. And there's a question here about whether the inside and the outside are matching up, whether they're consonant with each other. And one of the discussion questions that we posed that relates to this is about his relationship with Catherine. We see in this reading that he's really conflicted in his relationship with her, especially when he finds out about Dominique. And we'd ask people what they thought accounted for this conflict. And I want to see what people think about that right now in the chat. I'm going to review some of the data about this conflict in a moment. But as I'm doing this, thoughts from people who are watching. Why is Keating torn here? Why do you think he can't really decide about whether to marry Catherine or not? Let me see your thoughts on that in the chat. But while we're waiting for that, I mean, it's interesting. There was actually material in the earlier reading where we started to see some of the reasons why Keating, or at least we started to see signs of Keating's interest in Catherine, what it was about her that attracted him. She was the first one he wanted to tell when he got the job in New York, and he was coming to New York. At one point he says he feels a sense of freedom whenever she's around. He feels himself around her. He's unusually honest around her. He tells her that he uses people. And that's why he doesn't want to get too close to Tui through her. And even when his mom is now in the current reading, when his mother's asking questions about Dominique and suggesting that he, you know, get into a relationship with Dominique because it's the boss's wife and that can help him get ahead, even still, he's reluctant to consider it. He's feels relieved when all of a sudden Catherine shows up. And even though we'll talk in a moment about what he sees in Dominique, even though there's something his mother is saying that's appealing to him about Dominique, there are things about Dominique that he clearly doesn't like in a way that he does like them about Catherine. I mean, her eyes strike him as cold. He thinks she's looking on him with contempt. He knows at page 147, he says to himself, he dislikes her violently. And he tells his mother that he doesn't want Dominique. He tells his mother that he loves Katie.
Yeah. So we're getting some interesting answers in the chat here. So Ashley says that in the eyes of the public, Catherine seems sort of inferior compared to Dominique, who's more like the kind of trophy wife who'd be better for him in terms of public approval. So I think that's right. Katie is not a sort of glamorous woman who's going to help him advance his career. She's not the kind of woman that other people would view him as a success at having been able to marry her. Let's see.
Steve says it's the same reason he couldn't decide whether to go to Paris or New York at first. You know, which one is going to look more prestigious? Which one is going to help him get ahead? That was the main consideration on his mind.
Yeah, and Ellen says Peter did not have the courage of his own values. I think that's an important observation. He loves Katie, but cares too much about what other people think.
And Stephanie is saying similar things about what value Dominique has to offer. Brandon says he talks to himself about the fact he loves Catherine, that he can be real with her, but his worries about appearances win the end. A lot of other interesting comments here. It's worth pointing out a few things further about the way he sees Dominique. He's obviously struck by her looks. Everybody agrees that she's kind of devastatingly beautiful. I think it's interesting that he, even when he's looking at her, he looks at her in the way an artist would. Remember, he used to have an interest in being a painter. Though it's also interesting that the most that this ever means to him is a kind of distant admiration. It doesn't seem like not even her looks mean anything to him personally. Like, you don't get the sense that he desperately wants to hold her or be with her or something like that. Certainly he doesn't really enjoy the conversations with her. And nevertheless, when he's thinking of Dominique, it's always in relation to, as people are suggesting in the chat, what it will mean for the appearance he's presenting to other people. She'll look like a stunning accessory, in effect, on his arm. Of course, she's also the boss's daughter, and so it'll put him in a good place with the boss. Mm-hmm. And these are all the reasons why his mother especially is very interested in her. I especially the point toward the end, page 155, where she talks about, well, what will happen if he marries Catherine and therefore loses the favor of his boss, she says, he'll find plenty who will jump at the chance to take your place. How about that Bennett fellow? Not Bennett. This is just the same conversation that they had in the last reading about Stengel, not Stengel. Because he's got to, he feels like he's got to beat, he's got to be on top of everybody.
Or the guy at Stanton who would get the Beaux Arts scholar or would go work for Franken.
Oh, there was one too. I can't remember his name. Yeah, but it's
Flinker.
Yes.
Flinker will go work for Franken if you take the Beaux Arts scholarship.
Yeah. So what is this conflict really all about? Why is he so conflicted? It's not that he's like weighing the pros and cons of which of these two women he admires or loves more. It's instead, because it seems like he knows the answer to this question. He loves Katie, but that isn't entering into his decision, or at least it's not the decisive thing in his decision here. It's the question of, should I go by what I love or should I go by what other people want me to do, whether my mother or society or my boss?
Yeah, and at this stage of the novel, just at the end of part one, we don't have a decision. We see him, you know, we were left at the end of part one with him wavering on this decision. And maybe that's a good place to leave this question then at this point.
Yeah, I think so. But a lot of good comments in the chat to this effect.
I did want to comment. So Ellen also said, let me see if I can find this, that, so Ellen was the one who made the incisive comment that he doesn't have the courage of his own values. He cares too much about what other people think. And then you said also that he's just a literary device in a novel, not a real person. And I'd like to challenge that perspective on this because yes, he is a character in a novel and all the characters in this novel are stylized in a certain way. But the question is it a real phenomenon that there are people out there in the world who place, you know, the highest importance on other people's opinions and what other people think of them? I think that's a question to think about. We don't necessarily need to delve into this right now, but I think it's an interesting question to think about, because I think that, you know, it's a real phenomenon that Ayn Rand is drawing on in crafting this character. And that's true of all of her characters.
Well, yeah. I can even testify further to this, because I mean, a lot of people when they read The Fountainhead, and I think that they're not necessarily being insincere when they say they identify with Rourke and they, you know, they feel like they're standing alone against society. When I read this book for the first time, I identified with Keating. I thought I was that kind of person, and it scared me, especially since I admired Rourke more. And so that's one data point. I think there are others, and I knew others who were in the same position.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit more about Dominique, because I mean, she is a paradoxical character at this point in the story, not only to Keating, who is both attracted and repulsed by her, but to lots of other people as well. Certainly her own father doesn't really understand what makes her tick.
Yeah.
One of the questions that we had asked in earlier was, what do you think motivates Dominique? Her various career choices, her relationship choices. And I'd be interested in hearing what you all think in the chat. Especially, I'd be interested to hear from people who've not read this book before. Because if you've read the whole book, Dominique develops and we get a better idea of what's motivating her, but it's not at all clear from the beginning. And so people who are reading this for the first time, I'd be really especially interested to hear what you think makes her tick.
So in the first half of part one, which is a reading for last week, we hear about Dominique. This part, this second set of readings, the last half of part two, where we actually meet her and we see her talking and interacting, and we get some insights into her character. So that's why we want to bring her in at this point. Okay, so Gretchen says Dominique seems to see no positive purpose to her life. Okay. Any other thoughts from people?
Sam says she strikes him as nihilistic.
Okay.
Where I guess what you would mean by that, Sam, would be she just wants to she doesn't believe in anything. Sometimes it means she wants to destroy everything. I'm not quite sure about that, though there are some things.
She does attack in a certain way. She seeks destruction. So
a different Sam says she doesn't want to depend on others.
Yeah. So Dominique is probably one of the most interesting to me and probably one of the most complex characters in the novel. She behaves in all these incredibly puzzling ways. So we hear about her earlier in the novel, but we first meet her in person when she's come to Guy Franken's office, her father, because she's just written a column attacking the latest home designed by Peter Keating for the firm of Franken and Heyer in a really satirical, biting way. She trashes the design and pokes fun at it. And so and this is where we meet her. She's come to her father's office and he can berate her for doing this to him. And she just laughs at him. We hear her behind the door laughing at her father. So she does. She seems to be doing this just to amuse herself, right? And then on the other hand, at this party where they're celebrating Ralston Holcomb's Renaissance Capitol, and everyone, you know, she praised the design of the Capitol to the skies, even though she and everybody else thinks it's awful, right? So these are strange, puzzling things that she does. She seems to do these things just to amuse herself. Now, you know, we start to get a real look at a very much closer look at Dominique in this part where, so we know she's a writer for the Banner, and the editor of the Banner, Alva Skerritt, has cooked up this plan to look at these issue of landlords in New York, who they're called a landlord sharks. Like people, they're trying to have a campaign against the people who own these buildings. And so they send Dominique in, and she lives in the slums, and she experiences what it's like. You know, she experiences it firsthand, and then she goes to report on what she's seen, and she gives two talks. She gives a talk for a group of social workers who are sympathetic to the plight of the poor, and she points out all the hypocritical ways in which these poor people are shiftless and lazy and drunk and not really trying hard and all this sort of thing, right? Exactly the opposite kind of thing that you would say to the social workers if you wanted to get them on your side. And then she goes to a party, an elite cocktail party where a lot of these landlords are, and she points out all the ways in which they really are, you know, mistreating their tenants and failing to do upkeep on the buildings and all this sort of thing. So there's a way in which she's exposing the kind of certain hypocrisy on both sides of the issue, but it also comes across as though she's doing this just to amuse herself. You look like you want to jump in there.
Well, yeah, I mean, Alva Skerritt asks why she doesn't just reverse the occasions when she chooses to express her thoughts, presumably because then people would be on her side in each case. And she said there wouldn't be any point in that. I mean, and she's also saying they're both true. But she tells the truth to the people who want to hear it the least.
Yeah, so there's the issue of telling the truth, pointing, again, it's a form of exposing hypocrisy. That she seems to find relish in doing that. Now, the other aspect of this, though, is that she's doing exactly the opposite of what she should do if she's really trying to advance her career on the Banner, right? She kind of sabotages this whole scheme of Alva Skerritt's to make this a big campaign. And this is where we hear her talking about herself and her goals and her ambitions more. We get a glimpse into what's motivating her. So what are some of the things that we see about, what does she say about what's motivating her? You know, when Alva Skerritt asks her, what is she after? What does she say? Who remembers that?
One person already in the chat had it kind of answered your question in advance. Sonali mm-hmm. said she comes across as indifferent. She's indifferent between one outcome and another. But now Sam says she wants perfection. Ben says she wants perfection or nothing.
Yeah.
And those are both in that same conversation with Skerritt. That's page 144. And so she can't, how do you reconcile that? Well, she can't get the perfection that she wants. And so she takes the nothing. And that then explains the kind of indifference that I think Sonali is referring to.
Yeah. Now I just want to plant the seed here that I think on page 143 of the novel, we get that we see that there's a certain indifference, but there's also, she's got a real bitterness about the world, and there's a certain kind of fear that she expresses. So this is on page 143, where Alva Skerritt asks her, you know, doesn't she want a career, all this sort of thing, and she says, if I found a job, a project, an idea, or a person I wanted, I'd have to depend on the whole world. Everything has strings leading to everything else. We're all so tied together. We're all in a net. The net is waiting, and we're pushed into it by one single desire. You want a thing, and it's precious to you. Do you know who's standing ready to tear it out of her hand, out of your hands? So there's a way in which there's a certain kind of fear that if she comes to embrace something that's really precious to her, something bad could happen to it. And so given the choice between perfection or nothing, she'd rather have the nothing. And I think that's what people are responding to in the chat.
So even if perfection did suddenly appear, she's worried it would be destroyed for some reason, and then she would be devastated.
Yeah.
So it's like a defense mechanism of some kind to ward off loss.
And what's her view of the world? What's her view of people in the world? Does she have a positive view of her fellow man?
Well, Kate in the chat mentions this is why she breaks the statue. That's part of why she breaks the statue. Salimatu also mentions that. But what she explicitly says about the statue is that she doesn't want other people to see it. And so that implies certainly some kind of estimate of her fellow men. And there's that place on
page 143,
right, where she's talking about how there's this idea of mankind in general that we're supposed to have, but it's kind of vague. And when you really look down at who these people in general are, they're nothing but housewives haggling at pushcarts, drooling brats who write dirty words on sidewalks, and drunken debutantes.
Or their spiritual equivalent. So this is kind of
the range of people she'd been talking to with the landlord shark story.
So she has a very negative view of humanity and of the world. And she to the extent that she finds greatness, like the statue of Helios that she got from this museum in Europe, she doesn't want other people to, you know, in effect, these kinds of people that she has such disregard for, such a negative view of, they would so almost defile the work by merely looking at it. They're not good enough for it, and she doesn't even want them to see it.
It's an interesting question. How justified would this view of other people have been for her? So does she form this view because in fact she actually hasn't come across anybody all that inspiring? I mean, based on the people we know in her life so far, possibly not.
Yeah.
So we'll have to see what happens.
Yeah. So she's raised by Guy Franken, who is the kind of architect that we already get the sense that he's not the kind of architect we're supposed to admire in the novel. And all his friends, you know, the Holcombs and people like that are in a similar vein and so on.
So since you mentioned Franken, it's also probably worth pointing out that on page 145, there's this brief moment where Franken, who's been perplexed about her, still expresses internally, at least, some leftover fatherly affection for when she was young. And we have this memory of her leaping over this hedge in the defiant burst of ecstatic the greatest burst of ecstatic freedom he had ever witnessed in his life. So that doesn't sound like the person she is now. It doesn't sound like she started out this way in life. It sounds like she started out with a different view and something's happened to her, or she hasn't found what she's needed, or
But even in terms of who she is now, we get a glimpse that there's more to Dominique than this person who's bitter about the world, because, you know, when she goes to take on this assignment in the slums, right, she goes and lives in the slums, and it says, you know, she looks like she has TB because her slender figure, which in the drawing rooms just looks elegant, here it looks like she looks emaciated and sick. And yet she, you know, she goes and takes on this life with incredible competence and capacity, right? She peels potatoes and does all these things that people who live this way have to do. And it says she had never done this. This is on page 139. She'd never done these things before. She did them expertly. So she has a certain capacity for action and a strength of character that's there, you know, that's there under the surface, and it comes out in these moments. So there's more, there's a lot of interesting elements to Dominique's character. And we will learn more about her character as the novel proceeds. So far, I think what we have are glimpses of different aspects of it and ways in which she seems like a walking contradiction. She seems like a puzzle. And we'll learn more about why she seems to have these contradictory elements as the novel goes on. And we'll get more insight into her character in future chapters.
Yeah, Sally Matu in the chat, speaking, I assume, about Franken, says that he secretly admires and fears her at the same time. That might also be true of Keating, now that I think about it. So, Keith, we talked about whether we should do the question about Tui. Do you think it's half past? Do you think we still have time?
Yeah. I think we can, because I think we've said enough about Dominique for now. She'll play an important role in next week's session. So we can pause on her, and I think, why don't we move to the next question?
Yeah. So we are only starting to learn about this Ellsworth Tui character, and we don't really actually meet him at any point in the story. I mean, we see him speaking at the strike rally, but that's about it. Otherwise, most of what we get about him in this part of the reading is secondhand from Dominique, and especially from Catherine. And one question that we had posed about this in advance was, it seems both Keating and Catherine are conflicted about how to think about Tui. And the question was, why? What is it about Tui, who's Catherine's uncle, and who's also this prestigious architectural critic who writes for Gail Winans' paper, The Banner? Why are they conflicted about him? What is the nature of the conflict? And you see this, for instance, and I'd be interested to see what people in the chat say, but you see this in Keating, for instance. Early on, he doesn't really have much of a view of Tui, except that, well, he's this great critic and he would be honored to someday be written about by him. But then this strike happens, and it's the building trades are no longer building the buildings that Franken and Kyr are constructing, and so their work is stopping, and he's kind of annoyed by it. But of course, this is Catherine's uncle, and he's looking for Catherine one night, realizes she's gone to this rally where Tui's rumored to be about to give a speech. And of course, there are betting pools going on about whether he'll really give the speech, because if he does, it'll be bad for his career at the Banner, because Winans is the one who's building some of these buildings too. And then Tui shows up. And the first thing you get from Keating is, first of all, he hears Tui's voice, and he's enwrapped by the sound of it. And he's also impressed by the great applause, the thunderous applause that Tui gets when he goes on stage. And Keating feels like he could accept anything and be led blindly by this man. But then at the same time, he feels terrified about something and wants to get out and convinces Katie to get out. And she's got the same kind of ambivalence about her uncle. On the one hand, she's also feels like she has no will, and she's being swallowed by this nameless thing at the speech. And of course, it's her uncle. She speaks well of him. She thinks that he's trying to do good things for her. He's, you know, taken her under his wings. He doesn't even want her to go to work, would rather have her stay at home and study. But at the same time, she's also struggling with him. She feels afraid about something, such that Keating's able to convince her to leave this rally. And then there's this very curious scene around page 151, and this is when Keating had been talking with his mother about Dominique, and all of a sudden Katie breaks in, and Keating's somewhat relieved to see her, but she says that she's had this she's had this fright about her uncle. He's just been sitting at his desk, and she screams, and he doesn't hear her, and she's afraid of him, but she doesn't know why, because he's never laid a hand on her. And at this point, Keating remembers something about the way Tui's voice sounded. So what do people think about? What's the conflict about here? Can we even tell? What are people saying in the chat? Sophia says that she feels like it's a manifestation of their internal conflict between who they know they should be and who they are. That would suggest that it's something similar to the kind of conflict we were just talking about that Keating has about Catherine. That's possible. I think we'll need more evidence before we can decide on that. Like, what is it about Tui that makes, I mean, so we know that with Keating and Catherine, the conflict is what he really wants versus what he's going to appear to be for others. Why is his appearance so important in relation to Tui? I'm not saying it's not. That's something we need to figure out. What else is there?
Yeah, Ashley says the power he seems to have over people can be unsettling. Okay. I think we got a question in the chat here that I think is interesting to take up at this point. Steve asks, I was confused why Keating didn't want to use Catherine to meet Tui. So that's an interesting question. I think, we could pose that as a question in the chat. People can comment on that if they want to see if they have an answer for that. But what I would suggest is that it's because Catherine is the one sort of authentic value that Keating has. And even though he's perfectly willing to use people and manipulate and step on people to advance his career, he doesn't really like himself for doing that. And I think there's a way in which he feels that if he were to use Catherine to get to Tui, it would sort of sully the one authentic value that he has in life. And he doesn't want to do that. He doesn't want this sort of pure authentic value that he has to be sullied by the things that he feels guilty about in advancing his career. So I think that's part of the answer.
Johnny says he wants to earn that. I assume he means he wants to earn the attention as opposed to going through channels.
I think that's a very generous way of putting it, because I think what I was going to say is I think there are two components to it. One is it has to do with his relationship with Catherine, but another is it has to do with what he wants in terms of Tui. So Tui is this renowned architectural critic, and Keating ultimately wants Tui to recognize, to anoint Keating as a great architect and praise his work and that sort of thing. And I think to some extent, he's a little bit afraid of what Tui will think of him as an architect. And I think there's a way in which in part one, he's reluctant to meet Tui. He's not quite ready for it. He's not sure what Tui thinks of him. And so he doesn't want to face the possibility that Tui will reject him.
I hadn't thought of that. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's a lot of issues going on there.
Okay.
Okay.
We should move on to the last of the questions.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, so just to wrap up here. So we're going to, you know, part two of the book is titled Ellsworth Tui. So clearly we're going to learn a lot more about Tui. Notice that at this point, we haven't really actually met him in person. We've heard about him. We've heard about things he said. He was giving this speech, but we didn't actually see him on stage. They were outside the hall listening over audio. So we still haven't really met Ellsworth Tui yet. So clearly we will in part two, and we're going to learn a lot more about him and about his relationship with Keating and Tui and everybody else. So more to come on that. Now, the final question that we posed is starting to point towards the kind of philosophical themes that we're going to talk about in the book. And the question is that both Keating and Rourke at different points regard their actions as selfish. At different points in part one, they each describe themselves as, you know, that was a selfish act, or I'm being really selfish. So what do people think about that? Do you think that Keating or Rourke or both of them are right, or are they right in different ways? Who seems to be the selfish character?
And here especially, I think it's most relevant to hear it from people who are reading this book for the first time. What are your first impressions?
Yeah. So does Keating come across as a selfish character? Does Rourke come across as a selfish character? Do they both in different ways? What do you think? Sophia says they're selfish in different ways. Good. Okay.
I'd be curious to hear, Sophia, what the different ways are. In what way do you think Keating is? In what way do you think Rourke is?
So, Sophia, you say that they're selfish in different ways because the definition is subjective. So maybe say a little more about what you mean by that.
Who else has thoughts on this? Which one is selfish? Which one isn't? Maybe neither of them are. What do you think? Well, Keith, what are some of the ways in which Keating at least seems to be like a selfish person?
Okay, well, let's think about, okay, we got some more things here. So in the typical negative connotation of selfish that most people know, Keating is more selfish because he's seen to step on people and use others to advance his career. That's Ashwin saying that.
Yeah.
So that's an interesting way of looking at it. So there's a conception, there's a conventional way of thinking about what selfishness means. And according to that way of thinking about selfishness, there's a way in which it's clear that Keating seems to embody that. So if we think about in our society, what do we mean when we talk about a selfish person? It's the person who's in it for themselves, but at the expense of other people. So somebody who's willing to step on other people to advance their career. So remember what Keating does in part one. He backstabs, you know, he pushes people out of the way in the firm. He takes over Tim Davis's work and gets him fired.
Ben in the chat points out Keating basically destroyed Heyer. He basically killed him to get his partnership.
Yeah, he goads him into in this anticipated second stroke. I don't think he necessarily meant to do it consciously, but he knows that this is, you know, a real possibility. So I was going to build up to that. So he backstabs, and then he double crosses Guy Franken in order to push Claude Stengel out of the way. And as a designer, remember he's supposed to get the commission for Franken, and he ends up convincing the person to go with Claude Stengel so Stengel can go out on his own. So he double crosses his own, you know, boss and future partner. He in effect kills Lucius Heyer.
It's interesting that toward the end of a couple of places in the reading, he says it himself that he thinks he's selfish,
and he does it in a good way.
And he does it, but he does it always by saying everyone's selfish.
Yeah.
And it's especially interesting that he repeats that to himself after he basically kills Hire, as if to say, well, he's just done what everyone would have done. And it's sort of like to excuse what he's doing, as if, well, the way in which everybody's selfish, they don't have a choice about this fact. And so they can't be blamed for what they're doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But then are there ways in which this doesn't quite fit with his actions and thinking? Are there ways he isn't?
Well, I think, yeah. So, selfish? Okay. So let's put that as a question in the chat here.
Yeah. I mean, I think if you're right, Keith, that if you go by this conventional understanding of what it means to be selfish, doing whatever you want, no matter what it does to other people, there's a lot of evidence of that. But there are some things, and especially conversations he's having with other people in these readings that, and you might just say, oh, they're just rationalizations to make it seem like he's not being selfish. But mm-hmm. there are things that he says and that other people say about what he's doing that could lead you to question this. Anybody notice what they were?
So, I mean, for one thing, the idea that he's so focused on what other people think of him. So Augustine in the chat, I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly, all his actions are aimed to gain other people's approval and recognition. You raise the question of, is that insecurity, lack of self-esteem, right? Ashley says, Peter isn't selfish in the sense that he doesn't have a true sense of who he really is. And he's a product of the people around him. Johnny says he's searching for popular opinion to make up his own mind. So that's right. So there are things that he does where he doesn't really seem to be going after things that are real values of his. So he says he's in love with Catherine. He seems to hold her as a genuine value, but he doesn't go after her the way you would expect to see somebody doing it if it was a real genuine value of theirs. He's extremely passive about his relationship with Catherine. She's sort of the one value that he holds as a value that he authentically has on his own. It's not it's specifically not a value that other people would perceive as a value, or would increase his stature in society. We talked about that at the beginning. And so this is the one thing that you could say truly is something that he wants for himself, and yet he doesn't really go after it. She's the first person he wants to write to when he finds out that he's, you know, coming to work for Frank and he's going to go to New York. And then he arrives in New York and doesn't see her for 3 months. He'll go spend an evening with her and tell himself, oh, you know, I need to do this more often. And then just months will go by and he never goes after her. What about his interest in a career as an architect? I mean, this is something we talked about last week. Is that something that he does because it's a deeply felt passion of his? Well, we talked about this last week. This is not why he went into architecture. He went into architecture in order to achieve fame and prestige and recognition in the eyes of others, right? Yeah, go ahead, Ben.
It's interesting that when he's talking with his mother about Dominique, especially, the way she characterizes this whole attitude of what we've previously been talking about as how are you going to look in the eyes of others? She says, to get ahead in life, you need to make sacrifices. So not marrying Catherine would be a sacrifice. Mm. And she says it takes strength to deny yourself to win others' respect. So there's a kind of self-denial involved in catering to the interests and the views of others. Even when on the same topic, she says he should be thinking of others, including of her, when he's deciding whether or not, her being his mother, when he's deciding whether or not to marry Catherine.
Yeah. Okay, so I think at this point we have some evidence that suggests that in the conventional sense of selfishness, Keating does seem to exhibit that and embody that, but in other ways he doesn't. So I think it's an open question at this point.
So what about Rourke?
Well,
I think it might as well ask the chat the same question, but let's do it in reverse order because they're very different characters, right? So what are the ways in which Rourke seems to not be selfish? You might even think he's selfless. There's at least one character in this reading who thinks that. So why would someone think that about Rourke? That he's not selfish, that he's a kind of selfless martyr. Daniel mentions, well, he helps out Keating with his drawings. That's true. Ashley says he doesn't take things from other people. He doesn't expect anyone to give him anything. Angela says he doesn't intentionally harm people.
So Gretchen says he doesn't abandon his principles to, quote, get ahead. Mm-hmm. I think that's an important observation because there's a way within Rourke's approach to his architecture, to his work, he refuses to compromise his artistic integrity. Now, often in our culture, when you think about someone who refuses to compromise their artistic vision, you know, we often talk about a person like that as being in some ways a selfless martyr to an artistic ideal, right? That they're willing to sacrifice everything, fame, money, success, a vibrant career.
Johnny says he's serving a greater principle.
He's serving a greater principle. And that seems like there's a way in which in the conventional way we think about it in our culture, that can seem like an act of sacrifice, an act of selflessness, right? So I think that's right. And we see this, you know, this is the arc of what happens to him over the course of the novel, right? Because it's all the negative things that happen to him are a result of his unwillingness to compromise on his artistic principles. This is why he gets expelled from Stanton, because he doesn't design the way they want him to. This is why he gets fired from Guy Franken's office, because Franken wants him to put a, you know, classical design on a building, and he says he can't do it. He won't do it. I think the most significant scene is when he turns down the Manhattan Bank Building Commission. And remember the context for this. I think it's really important. Ayn Rand really sets the context for this well. He's down to his last $14. He hasn't paid the rent on his office or his apartment in a couple of months here. The phone, you know, the phone is in danger of being turned off because he hasn't paid the utility bills, right? This is his last hope for being able to stay in business. And they want him to do the building. They've accepted him on this one small condition that he make this little compromise to his artistic vision for the building.
And by the way, Rourke, at this point, when he gets the phone call, he thinks they're going to give it to him, and he's you know, he's regained his hope, and he pays for the cab that he can't afford, so he's all set up finally to turn things around.
Yeah.
But
and he knows that if he doesn't get this commission, he has to leave the field of architecture, maybe temporarily, but maybe forever. And you know, the only option that he can see as far as earning a living is to go take a laborer's job. So he basically knows he doesn't yet have the idea for the job, but it's basically he's going to be breaking rocks in a granite quarry, almost like a convict, if he doesn't get this job. And yet he refuses to compromise on his design, and he gives up the commission. Now, and there's this very interesting exchange. Well, now what's interesting, and this is maybe a transition to the second part of what ways does Rourke seem selfish, because Wheedler, the guy who on the Manhattan Bank board who offered him the opportunity to do it in the first place, says, how can you be so, what does he say? He says, how can you be so fanatical and selfless about this? You know, and so he he expresses this idea that we've been discussing, that Rourke is a selfless martyr to his artistic vision, right? And what does Rourke say? We're already getting into the chat. That was the most selfish. So, and Rourke is surprised by this comment. The guy calls him selfless, and Rourke is sort of taken aback. He says, that was the most selfish thing you've ever seen a man do. So that's interesting to ask, in why is that the most selfish thing you've seen a man do? Now, we'll have a lot more to say on that later in the book. But in terms of what we see in part one, what are some of the ways in which Rourke does seem selfish? What are some of the, so we've talked about the ways in which he seems like a selfless martyr to an artistic ideal. And he doesn't seem, you know, he's certainly not somebody who takes the path that Keating takes, where it's all about trampling on people to advance his career. He seems to do everything he possibly can to sabotage his career in the conventional sense, right? So what are the ways in which Rourke seems selfish?
Yeah, I want to point out one passage that I think is really noteworthy, and I hadn't paid as much attention to it on previous readings, but it's clear that he loves what he's doing in a way that Keating doesn't. And he loves the things that he creates. And you get a sense of how selfishly he seems to love them. On page 134, when he's working on the Heller House, and it says, there were moments when something rose within him, not a thought nor a feeling, but a wave of some physical violence. And then he wanted to stop, to lean back, to feel the reality of his person heightened by the frame of steel that rose dimly about the bright, outstanding existence of his body at its center. And he goes on, and the workers comment on how the guy's in love with the thing. He can't keep his hands off it. And that's in stark contrast to Keating. When Keating's working on a design and he's simply channeling the views of others into his design, he feels there's always emptiness that he feels. He feels like he's being sucked into a hole. And he doesn't have a sense of his person, of his own person, in the way that Rourke does.
And last week we talked about, we sort of paused on certain moments where that showed Rourke's passion for his work. So we talked about the scene at the very beginning of the novel where he's supposed to go meet with the dean, and he sees something in a drawing, and he sees what the mistake that he made, and he puts the drawing down. He spends an hour later, he's correcting the design. He's forgotten all about the meeting with the dean. And I mentioned last week, there are more scenes that kind of where it shows his passion for his work.
The Sanborn House.
This was the Heller House is one. Now, and remember, even just the buildup to this. So this is when he's working for John Eric Snite. And he's got this whole team of designers, and he brings them out there. Rourke goes back to the site time and again, and he's drawn to it. And you can see that he's got this incredible work of art, you know, brewing in his mind. And I think it's important to think about, we're not just talking about any kind of house here. There's a way in which the kind of house that Rourke ends up designing in the Heller House is the kind of building that becomes, I don't know if you can all see behind me here, I've got a picture of Frank Lloyd Wright's building, Falling Water. Now, I'm not saying that there's any connection between the design for the Heller House and Falling Water, but it's the kind of building, I mean, she does talk about these cantilevered terraces going out over the ocean, and the way in which the elements of the building sort of complement the natural surroundings. And that's all, so, but if you think about a building like this, Falling Water by Frank Lloyd Wright, this isn't just any old house. This is a house that's become one of the greatest masterpieces of American architecture, and it's a museum, and people can go visit, and they put posters of it on their wall. And if you think about the way the Heller House is described, it's that striking and significant a building, and people come and they stare at it from the road. I mean, it's you know, Austin Heller lives there. It's not like they can go in there, but people come and look at it. It's a so Rourke has in him the ability to create a buildings like that, buildings that are absolute unique masterpieces. And so I think it's just, it's important to stress that that's the kind of thing we're talking about here. It's not just he loves building and he likes to build houses. He's creating masterpieces.
Keith, we're getting close to time here.
Oh, goodness. So
should we pause to take a last couple of questions? There's two or three in the, both in the chat and in the Q&A, which we could probably do quickly.
Okay, sure.
So, yeah, sorry to cut you off there. I was just noticing that's the good. Clock. Steve in the chat asked if Rand had any inspiration for the Austin Heller character. And there is some evidence that she did in her journals. At certain points when she's developing that character, she refers to him as Mencken. And that would be H.L. Mencken, who was also a journalist who had kind of individualist political views, who she, I think, even corresponded with briefly. Mm-hmm. So that's a little bit of evidence there. Steve in the Q&A asks, what did Rand think of the movie version of The Fountainhead? Well, first of all, I'm going to say, anybody who's listening, I strongly recommend finishing the book before you watch the movie, because I think it's always best to form your own images of these characters in your mind before you let the movie start to influence it. She wrote the script for The Fountainhead and had a battle with the producers to have it be produced exactly as written, in just the same way that Rourke had battles with his various boards of directors, but she won. It did get filmed basically as she wanted it to. She regarded it as a sincere attempt. She didn't think that it was high art, the style of films from earlier in the century that she liked, but she thought it was good for what it was trying to do. And yeah, I think it's worth checking out if you have time. It's, I'm sure, on all of the iTunes and various kinds of services where you can rent a movie. I won't say what I think, but that's for you all to decide.
So Johnny says, let's do 2 hours. And I wish we could, because this is a lot of fun, but unfortunately we do have to draw a line here. So do you want to just say your wrap-up comments, Ben?
Yeah, let me just reshare my screen so that I can tell you and remind you about what's on tap for next week. Next week, we'll of course be meeting at the same time of day on Friday, Friday, April 17th. We will now be working our way into part two of The Fountainhead, the first 8 chapters, about 92, 91 pages of reading. This is the one that's entitled Ellsworth Tui. So as Keith mentioned before, we're gonna get much more insight into what this character is all about, and we'll see his role in the novel begin to increase, but always against the backdrop of Rourke. So that's all I've got. I hope you all are getting something from these sessions. Please, if you are interested, look to the Fountainhead Facebook page, where we're posting our questions in advance. We're posting these typically on Mondays. And I haven't seen too many people yet writing in response, but if you do add a comment to those posts with what you think are the answers to some of these questions, we'll try to incorporate some of your thoughts into our discussion if we think you have interesting things to say. So please take a look at that, and we will see you all next week.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live podcast. If you like what you hear, leave us a review, share with a friend, and subscribe to our other podcasts. This podcast is made possible by donors to the Ayn Rand Institute. Help support this podcast by becoming an ARI member. Go to aynrand.org/membership.